Hi, I'm Nick.
I am Bonsu.
And I'm Bryn. And this is Chalk It Up, a podcast that celebrates all things Sussex through stories and conversations with inspiring local people.
In this episode, we spoke to award-winning documentary filmmaker Barney Douglas. Barney spoke about all of his films, the most recent of which is an intimate portrait of tennis world champion John McEnroe. Barney also talks about the importance of music in his films and his experience of growing up in Sussex and now living in Lewes. We really appreciate you taking the time to give this a listen, and we hope you enjoy.
What was John McEnroe like when you first met him?
What was he like when I first met him?
I'm trying to think where I did for... So he lives in, obviously, near Central Park in New York. And I don't know if it is actually the building that was in Ghostbusters, but it looks quite a lot like that building.
No, what, the fire station, the one where they have Zool
Zool's at the top. So it's very similar to that building. And... so we've got in a elevator at the bottom.
Yeah.
The kind of doorman ushers you in. My name was down. Got in the elevator. So I've never met John at this point. So I go up in the elevator and it's one of those ones where it opens into his like penthouse.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and McEnroe was there in a dressing gown and slippers, looking sweet. Pretty worse for wear. It was about 11:30, but I think he'd been out for a few jars the night before. So he sort of grunted and...
yeah,
beckoned me in.
Right. Do you know what? I'm just imagining this sort of silky kind of dressing gown with like fluffy.
I think it might have been his wife Patty's dressing gown. So I went in, and that's when I first met John, and just kind of it was pretty surreal because you sort of see this incredible vista of New York out across the window, and he is the penthouse. You know, he's got that space, and. And then we just sort of sat around the kitchen table and chatted about this potential film.
So this is before sort of anything's been agreed and buttoned down.
Yeah, so he wasn't officially on board at that stage.
Right.
There was a bit of pressure on me not to crumble.
Wow. And how did you pitch it to him? In terms of what was in it for him? Did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to be, and did it stay that way, or did it evolve?
Yeah, good question. I had a pretty clear idea of the kind of tone, I suppose, of what the film would be, and I didn't at that point. I had a feeling of like what I wanted it to feel like. And it wouldn't be sort of the kind of staid documentary that he'd had a few TV documentaries done about him and stuff like that. It'd be nothing like that. It'd be really like as big screen, like ambitious as possible and bold, and would be something that, yeah, hopefully he would be proud of, but also wouldn't be, you know, a puff piece or anything like that. I sensed quite early on that he's very sharp and very intelligent, and he analyses you in the room. For weakness.
He sizes you up.
Okay. Wow.
If you show a backward step, that's not a good thing. But if you're too egotistical or aggressive, that's also not a good thing. So you just got to kind of tread that line. So you've got to be confident in what you're saying and what you're communicating, and be clear, but at the same time, you know, not overstep your mark.
Yeah. So it's like kind of being yourself in a way.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that's it. Just having a confidence in yourself and what you're doing. And it was the first meeting, so he didn't expect like the whole film to be mapped out or anything. But I think he just wanted to get a sense of who I was and whether we could potentially, I guess, do something together. Yeah. Mm. Because, and one of his questions was, you know, why should I do this at my time? Why no one wants to watch a film about me, blah, blah, blah. Which is obviously an opportunity to sort of butter him up a little bit. But, so I think I just generally communicated, I guess, similar things that he wanted to hear. And then what happens, I just went away and read and researched and wrote and Zoom called with him. And like, I quickly played in music and stuff like that because he was really interested in music. He's not interested in tennis like in the film, really. He was just interested in music, so I would be playing him tracks and just sort of bonding, I suppose. Mm. But I was quite... Go on.
Oh, no, I was... Well, that's so funny because I was going to ask you how on earth you choose music for your films because it's so always so good. And I always thought, oh, what a lovely thing to do, to choose the music for a film. And then I actually thought about it for a while. I was like, oh, it's such a big decision. And there's so much. How on earth do you choose the music for your films?
I agree. It's one of the best. Yeah, it's one of the fun bits of it. But essentially, I always go into a film with a tone and an idea and a visual sense of what it's going to be. And also musically, I've got an idea of what I kind of want to push it towards. And then when you get in the edit, sometimes tracks that you've already thought of work brilliantly with what you've got. And sometimes they don't. So you have to adjust and all that kind of thing. But usually when you get that moment, if you've got a particular track and it's in a sequence and you've imagined it and you put it in there and it just goes, like, elevates the sequence, you know you're onto a good thing. But then you have to go into the murky world of clearing it. So, for example, there's a Pink Floyd track called Welcome to the Machine in McEnroe, which is over his first Wimbledon win. And the whole country is kind of raging against him, and Maggie Thatcher hates him, and like all the punks love him, and like all this kind of stuff.
Right.
So he's really like, it's really him against England, essentially. I think it's Thatcher in Wimbledon crowd and stuff like that. So anyway, we done this edit with "Welcome to the Machine" by Pink Floyd because that was quite an odd. For other people, that might have been quite an odd choice, but for me, it was the moment. Actually, McEnroe was such a punk and a rebel, and once he won Wimbledon, that was the end of that. It changed slightly. Right. It changed slightly. So I felt like that track was a really interesting choice. We wrote for permission, sent the scene with the music edited, and described what I felt the track was about and why it fitted there. And, you know, there's a really great little moment, if anyone's seen the film, where a particular piece of McEnroe vocabulary, shall we say, lands on a particular politician with the music, and it's pretty satisfying. So I figured that would appeal to the band's politics as well. So for all those reasons, that's how we got that track in there.
Right.
So there's lots of little roads to getting good pieces of music in there.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just what the image and the vision of the film.
And I suppose when you're telling a story about an era, then you've got an embarrassment of riches of his era in terms of music, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's such a great time for bands, for punk, and then like kind of post-punk, and then and even movie soundtracks as well. There for me, there was a film called Thief, which was a really big influence on McEnroe. Bizarrely, it was an early Michael Mann film, and James Caan is in it, and it's like mostly at night, and it's these neon blues and kind of like this slightly synthy. Tangerine Dream did the soundtrack, and like it's this kind of, and that was like,
so you still like
that whole movie for McEnroe, genuinely very proud of. So that was a real, real big influence. So the kind of music and the synthiness and the neons and the scratchy kind of stuff of New York and all that kind of thing, that was very much an early aesthetic. And so the music had to serve that, really.
So how do you talk about how do you decide with music, how do you decide what story or which stories to tell? Because you've made three or four absolutely brilliant documentaries. They tell a really specific story really, really well. How do you land on that when you've got, again, just what must be a paralyzing amount of choice to go, what is it about these particular subjects that speaks to you? How does it happen?
I was going to say, did you mean like a story within the film or the actual film itself?
I mean the subject. The subject first, because the other thing I'm really interested in is the story and how you structure it and how you go about it. But I'm going to ask about that in a minute.
Subject. Seriously, just a lot of the times what you get offered or what the opportunity is. I mean, there are so many films that I've come up with an idea for, or I've written a sort of brief treatment for or something, and a week later, it's, you know, press release. Oh, so-and-so has just announced their documentary, or so-and-so. So actually, there's a huge amount of stories, but access to them, that's really what documentary is all about. Right. It's about access. And that's why originally I loved documentary, because one of the reasons was because I felt it was quite democratic. If you had the kind of get up and go, or you found a story and you built relationships with people, then you were in pole position to make that story, essentially, or to make that film, or to try and move that film forward. Subsequently, that's changed a lot now, because the documentary form has grown massively. So streamers have huge departments that hoover up rights to stories. So it's a very different landscape. But certainly when I started, that was what it was. And my first film, which is about Maasai warriors playing cricket in Kenya, which, you know, is charming, obviously flawed, but charming film in a lot of ways. But I was very naive, you know, like I just kind of found a story. I was working bizarrely in cricket at the time.
Yeah.
So I thought strategically, I knew I wanted to make a documentary, and I thought strategically in terms of, well, this isn't a sport that I know. I know a lot of the media in that sport, so they can maybe give me a bit of coverage. And I knew some of the England cricketers at the time that might help promote the film a little bit. So it's all very basic stuff, but I was thinking, that was my thinking. And I sort of saved a bit of my own money and started it and made it that way, really.
And at its heart, a really compelling story.
Yeah.
So when you first, explain the sort of, the synopsis of it, really, for the benefit of our listener.
Well, I'd seen a picture in one of the national papers of a Maasai warrior with all the traditional clothing and bead wear and warrior wear, playing like a cricket shot. With this, you know, like an incredible, it was a great photograph. So immediately, visually, I was like, wow, that's incredible. What's that about? So then sort of researched the story, and it turned out that there was this Maasai cricket team that had been formed in Kenya. And they were not only enjoying the game, but they were using it to kind of raise awareness of, I think, gender equality. They were teaching girls to play cricket as well, and try and promote the rights of the human rights of their sisters and family, because they were young men growing up, and the elders were very much sort of
traditional.
Very traditional. And I think the youngsters are starting to get, obviously, access to, as the internet had grown and everything, and sort of changed their perspective on some of the more, in their opinion, harmful traditions. So they were using sport to kind of raise awareness of themselves and then bring a social message along with it. So I just got on a plane and went out there to meet them. That's basically what I did.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah, that's absolutely just what I did. I sort of emailed the captain, I had an email address. I can't remember where I got it from, but I got in contact with them and just said, would you mind if I came and visit?
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And it was naive. And I think I look back now and I sort of think, there's definitely things I think, well, maybe I could have done that differently, or maybe I should have approached that in a slightly different way, or... But generally speaking, the experience was really, really great, I think, for everybody involved in the team and the village. Like, I had to go to the elders first and ask their permission to speak to people in the village and so on and so forth. So you had lots of meetings to make sure that they understood why I was there and gave me kind of their permission to be there. And it was really, like, the elders were really interesting people because... I was expecting, I guess, a lot of resistance to my presence potentially, but it was quite the opposite. They were very welcoming. They wanted to discuss it. To discuss kind of where the future was lay and all this kind of stuff. So it was really, it was interesting. But I do think, gosh, I was definitely, it was 13, 14 years ago probably, but I was definitely sort of quite naive, I think.
Yeah.
And I probably would do things a little differently now. That being said, I'm still proud of the film and still in touch with some of the guys and stuff like that.
I think, from my viewpoint, I think it's such a brave thing to do. And perhaps, you know, taking the braveness out of it, you know, you were trying to tell a story. But did it feel like you discovered something?
I think, it did actually. It felt probably the purest documentary I've made, I would say. The subsequent ones they are stories that have in the main happened already, and you're looking back and you're finding creative ways to bring an older story to life. Mm. Whereas Warriors, which is the first one, most of it was happening just in front of the camera. And there's a real magic to that. There's a real magic to seeing relationships in front of the camera forming, bonds, humour, natural love between people, and little moments. That's what you look for. You're just looking for little moments of truth, essentially. And that's when it really speaks to me, documentary. Mm. And I still get that in some of the others, as in The Edge, which I did, and in McEnroe. There are moments where I'm like, ah, yeah, there it is. There's that moment that you're looking for. But when you're doing a documentary and it's happening in front of you, you just tend to get more of them.
Yes.
And it feels alive in a very different way, because it's, you're not looking back at anything, it's happening there and then. So yeah, I felt really, really privileged to be there. I loved Kenya. I loved having the chance to be in that environment. I felt very, like, I don't know, like, you know, out with a fire in the middle of nowhere, and just sat around the fire with the kind of Maasai team and chatting, even when the camera's off and all that kind of thing. Just felt like, you know, a life moment that you couldn't really, documentary had taken me there, really, and that's pretty special. Yeah, and we made it for not a lot of money, scratched it together. I think I still owe, like, I still owe something on a credit card, somewhere.
Did you edit it as well? Who edited it?
I edited the first portion of it, and I absolutely got in a tangle with it.
Really?
So difficult to edit your own things. I admire anybody that can do it. So I started, so the sequence that I edited that are still in the film, but in terms of those themes that you start at the beginning of the film and hopefully tie up at the end, and these long-form storytelling is an art. So a guy called Julian Rod came on board and just kind of, like, rescued me from the pits of despair.
So why is it so hard to edit your own stuff? Is it because you're too invested, or you don't have the perspective of... of what you might need to make those brutal decisions?
That's exactly it. I think, particularly when you're less experienced, you know what went into every shot. Mm. You know how difficult some of them were to attain. For example, I mean, I sold my car to get a drone, to get drone shots in Kenya.
Yeah, you're kidding.
And it crashed first time.
Oh, no!
So it went over across this bit of Clearfall field or wherever, and we got it back, and it looked great. I was like, this is amazing. So we sent it off again, and I think there's a military base somewhere nearby, and obviously the and it just dive bombed. Car was essentially like Senji just falling through the air. Crunch. And there's like the briefest of drone shots in the film, and that was all we got back from it. So, like, you know, like, so that drone shot was going in but yeah, that's essentially it. You have all that knowledge behind it. But beyond that, I think, and what I've learned, is that I now try and build in, if possible, gaps. So when you're in the edit, you get to a certain point and you go away for 2 weeks. You get out there, because it's amazing how difficult it becomes the further you are into the process. And amazing how easy it is if you then watch that film again, you know, like 6 months later, you're like, oh, why didn't I just do that? It's so obvious. But when you're like
there
and you're in the woods with it, it's very, it can become quite difficult. So I think I wouldn't, if I can avoid it, I would try not to edit, you know, my own stuff. I'm in the edit, but I've found a system where I kind of do maybe a couple of days a week with the editor that I work with, a guy called Steve Williams. I'll do a couple of days with him, and I'll leave him to also express himself and bring what he's good at to the table. He sends me stuff, and then I'll do a couple of days fresh and go in. And so that's kind of worked really well for us.
And so going back to that question I was alluding to earlier around storytelling and structure. You know, how... you know, without sort of revealing too much of your sort of secrets, how do you go about structuring and sort of telling that story? Because you know, fictional films, feature films, tend to follow quite a standard format a lot of the time, really, don't they?
Yeah, I think...
Or there's sort of only so many stories that tend to get retold. You're telling real stories, what's your approach for structuring storytelling?
I think generally speaking, so it depends what kind of documentary it is, but let's take McEnroe, for example, which I think is quite an interesting, probably the most challenging one structurally, for a number of reasons. Firstly, his career, a successful element of his career, is quite front-loaded. So it happened from like 77 to 84, but like really from 1980 to 84, he won everything. He was the best in the world. He was an incredible player. And then he just kind of like faded away for the next 8 years. So he didn't go out necessarily with a massive bang. So there was no like natural end point to his career. So that was the first issue with it. And the second one was kind of like, so how also do you cram this guy's life into a 90-minute film? So you have to make decisions on, firstly, the archive. What archive best, what is the strongest archive and what does it best communicate? So that influences your decision, what sort of routes you'll follow. But with McEnroe, I kind of put all these things in the pot and I sort of, and my own influences from Thief and things like that, I thought, okay, well, I want to somehow, the thing it doesn't have is a container. You can't contain this story. There's not a natural ending to it cinematically or anything. So he's still alive and well, you know, you haven't got this kind of, Senna, as brilliant as that film is, that every frame in that film is coloured by the fact that you know that he's dead, that you know this crash is coming. So everything you look at, every shot you look in, it's all loaded with the knowledge of that, which makes it really powerful. You don't have that with McEnroe. Quite the opposite. You have every shot and most people hate him. So so you're fighting against that. So I figured, okay, well, why don't we try and trace his steps from Douglaston, which is where he was born, to where he is now, which is Central Park, New York, and kind of basically the love of his life, somebody that accepts him and understands him for who he is. I felt that that was the journey I wanted to tell. Mm. And the sport supports that along the way. So I thought, okay, well, let's try and tell it over one night. And that's the impression of it being over one night, because you get a Dusk Till Dawn feeling. It gives you a natural beginning and end. So as the sun's coming up at the end with the love of his life, that gives me that kind of cinematic release where I can go feel satisfied that that's the end of the journey. So that was how that was the sort of framework I placed on it to structure the whole film. And then he would go, in an ideal world, he would go through and just encounter people on his way. And from there, we'd like siphon off into the archive, into those sorts of stories. It was made during COVID, so we were a bit limited with, you know, amount of people we'd have liked him to meet and all that kind of stuff. So that's how I chose to do that story, because it needed that framework.
You say, so he's met the love of his life, who accepts him for who he is. Does he accept himself, do you think?
Well, that's the interesting thing with John. I don't think he thinks that much about it. I think the most he's ever thought about it is me, like, pressing him in these interviews. I think he has grown to see his impact on others around him, and particularly through Patty and his daughters, has learnt to change his behaviour because he doesn't want to affect them negatively. But he doesn't, and this is just my opinion, he doesn't think it's not a major concern to him. Like, he doesn't need to kind of work himself out that much, if that makes sense. But I feel that we got somewhere with him. I feel like he got quite vulnerable and quite raw, and I'd never seen him like that before. So I feel like it did push him to a few places. And I think the process of making the film, actually, and subsequently watching it continually, made him think about those things more than beforehand, or even during the interviews. I think subsequently seeing it all there, like laid as a piece of evidence in front of him, I think is what's made him potentially think more about that.
That's pretty magic, isn't it?
I think so. I think with somebody like John, I think that I am quite proud of that, definitely. And you know, he absolutely would tell you what he thinks. So whenever he said to me that he's really proud of it, then I believe him, because he would definitely tell me if he
was. Yeah, it sounds a bit more kind of therapeutic, isn't it? Like going through your kind of life and then also things that you look back to and then where you are. Because obviously you cannot be even... He cannot be like that all the way through. You play with aggression, passion, and you have this kind of one-line vision during that time. And when you come out and, you know, I bet he's a bit older now and he's wiser. And, you know, so look back at it and actually he's almost kind of, ooh, I feel therapy, you know.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And that's exactly how that last, probably the last half an hour of the film feels to me. Like, we moved the camera closer and closer during that spell. And I think across the film, broadly speaking, the camera slowly gets closer to him. And the last half an hour is definitely, it feels to me like a therapy session. It's intense, I think, for somebody, you know, for a sports person. I've not really seen many living sports people kind of that, I think, open, really, and raw.
Yeah, and vulnerable.
Particularly somebody like him, who spent his life never even going near a lot of that stuff. So, yeah, that's definitely what I'm probably most proud of with that film. But, like, in every documentary, you've also got to remember you can get carried away with, oh, I need this for the film, or I need this, or I need this. And you forget that there's, like, these are human beings who are giving you, like, the privilege of putting their story or elements of their story or their personality on screen for everyone to see. No matter who they are, you know, like from the Maasai team to McEnroe, it's a privilege. I think you have a moral responsibility to be as fair and personally empathetic as possible, really. I think, like, a lot of people wanted to dislike McEnroe and dislike the film by extension because of that. So you go into it knowing that. So I just wanted to make sure that actually the one thing I hadn't seen with John was any empathy. I'd never seen any TV show or documentary or anything that actually said, well, okay, this guy isn't just one thing.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of different things going on with him. So let's come at it from a different angle. So that was I was very clear about that from the outset.
And it's very easy to think of him as a one-dimensional character, particularly in the 80s when everyone knows who he is, everyone knows, you know, what he looks like. If you saw his silhouette, you'd be able to sort of spot it.
Incredible.
And I was talking about him with with a whole load of mums on Mother's Day. My mum, my wife's mum.
Borg or McEnroe, they tend to be.
So the subject of John McEnroe came up. And people of our parents' age in their sort of 70s are like, oh yeah, he was, you know, just very aggressive and didn't have like very sort of warm things to say about him. But it's like all you've seen is this sort of one side about it. I remember distinctly being a 7-year-old and dressing up as John McEnroe on my front lawn with a headband on and a cricket bat, you know, the ones with like the long straight angle, like bashing it on the ground. And like, he was so famous, like everyone knew who he was. And I love the rock and roll element of it, the story as well. And like Keith Richards talking about it.
Like, that's classic though. John was like, well, I want Keith Richards in it.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the stipulation.
He was like, I want Keith Richards in it. I was like, well, I don't know, like, are you really good mates? Like, what's the... He's like, I've been at parties with him and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, if you think he'll do it, then yeah, for sure. That'd be really cool. It'd be fun. And we got Keith... I mean, I have to say, he wasn't the best interview that I've ever done.
Really? Because he seems like such a rock and roll... He's all of the Stones. They seem so open and just...
Yeah, I think they kind of... They're quite savvy. They kind of save some of the best bits for... You know, their stuff. You know, I think a lot of people now are quite savvy. They don't give too much away to a film that they're not, you know, like fully a part of. But I really liked him. I mean, I really like John as well, but I really like Keith Richards. We had half an hour with him, you know, like nervous, like, can't wait back. It's Keith Richards. And then he said, oh, where are you from? And I said, oh, just outside Brighton near Lewis. He's like, oh, Yeah, yeah, I thought so. Like, going for a beer in Lewis or something, because he owns a place not far from here.
Really? Really? You're kidding.
He owns somewhere up near Maresfield or somewhere like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he just loves gardening. So that's so he, once he knew where I was from, he was sound.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I never knew he had a place in Maresfield. Johnny Depp had a place in Maresfield, didn't he? Yeah, I think so. People used to see him like staggering into the pub. What's the pub on the high street? It's really nice.
I don't know.
It escapes me. But he's clocked you. Yeah.
But I think the rock and roll, that's the fun. We wanted to kind of try and get a sense of New York and rock and roll and like these guys are out partying and all this kind of stuff. And that you know, the rock stars wanted to be tennis players and vice versa. So so it was really just even for my own like kind of fanboy. It was just really nice to get the chance to meet Keith Richards. but it was pretty funny because his manager, who was lovely, she said, "Oh, he'll be a few minutes. He's just getting into character."
So, no way.
Yeah, so I think he was sort of,
is that a euphemism?
So I don't know, psyching himself up to be grilled. So that was that. To be honest, we met a load of people through the film that I'd never have thought I would have been in a room with. I mean, Billie Jean King is my favourite interview.
But she is
just
like
force of nature. Such an impressive person, and such a great speaker, like a documentarian's dream. Someone who just reels off these lines that are natural and expressive, and because that's what you're looking for, like to join your story and your narrative together. You need words, you know. So she was great.
So you said that you get these moments, these sort of very real moments that are sort of unfolding in front of you, or things that you feel sort of very pure, very genuine. As a documentary maker, do you find yourself sort of constantly chasing those, or do you have to sort of stay on task with what you're doing?
Well, that is a good question. I think you're always just hoping. Trying to create an environment that feels as natural and as comfortable as possible, particularly doing like a sit-down interview. Mm-hmm. I hate lots of people there. I don't like any of that. I don't like too much tension, just a couple of people, you know, camera and me and sound, and that's it, really. And just try and very much make it like this, a conversation. Yeah. Some interviewers are very, you know, they do have their list and bang, 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 and they don't really engage with what you say. They just, and that's not how I do it. And there are definitely benefits to doing things that way. When it comes to the edit, you've got very clear, sort of punchy answers. But I feel the best stuff is when you enter into conversation and it goes where it goes, and you actually allow the contributor to express themselves and sort of unlock doors. You know, that's what I feel. A good documentary interview is, it starts somewhere and you just find keys as you go along and unlock the different doors until you get to, hopefully, something that's quite pure. That's what I try and do, and obviously sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask next is, how nervous are you that it's sort of not going to happen? Because you get sort of, you know, you've got half an hour with Keith Richards, that's the only shot you're going to take at that. That's probably whenever you're interviewing someone, it's very hard, must be very hard to sort of go back and say, that interview was a bit rubbish. Yeah. Can we do it again, but with a little bit more?
Yeah, you rarely get a second chance. I think it's also just about realism. Like, you don't get, like, for example, with John, the stuff that I really love, it took a day and a half probably to get him to come down and just settle and eventually calm down to a point where he would start to go places. But we had that time, so we knew that. So I wasn't really worried with that at all. It's just realism. If you get half an hour with Keith Richards, you're not going to go in deep in anything. You're not going to get, you need to know what each interview, I guess, the purpose it serves, I suppose, without being too prescriptive. You need to know that, okay, I'm going in, I've got 20, eventually I'll have 20 minutes with Keith Richards. I know that all I'm speaking to him about is the fact that he went partying with McEnroe. Mm. I just need one funny story or one line that I know that's going to get that away, combined with the archive, it's going to justify that in the film. So, like, that's what I would be looking for in that instance. But yeah, with others, you're looking for a lot more. I did a film called The Edge with the England cricket team, and well, I had 2 hours with each player. That was it,
really.
No. Which seems, I think now, and I'm like, gosh, that's not much at all, actually. But like, for example, there's an interview with Jonathan Trott I did, which was, I knew Trotty a bit beforehand, so there was a relationship established, but he went there. And I don't think I necessarily, it was a good interview, but I don't know if I earned that emotion, in the 2 hours, I don't know. But it's a beautiful interview, so sometimes it just happens for you. I don't think it helps if you put pressure on yourself, I've got to get like something they've never said before, or I've got to make, McEnroe cry, or I've got to I just don't think it's natural. I think you just trust yourself to have a good conversation with someone. And if you have a good conversation, then more often than not, something good's going to come from it, I think.
You've got a bit of a background in cricket though, right?
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
So is that your professional background and a love? And I'll preface this with, I've never quite understood cricket.
No.
I mean, I'm happy it exists.
It's a, yes.
A lot of people love it. I know so little about it.
Well, it allows for a lot of drinking and hollering in the stands, basically, a test match. I just came from my dad. I loved cricket as a kid, but to be honest, I was at university. I didn't know what I was going to do afterwards. I had a mate who worked at Sussex Cricket Club and said, "Oh, in the summers they need someone to come and like film the training or like just do some filming and for their stats and stuff." And I was like, "Well, sounds like better than working in TK Maxx or whatever." So I'll do that as a summer job. And I just sort of started creating little videos for the players. So we'd have some match action and have a bit of behind the scenes because I keep the camera rolling and a bit of documentary, there'd be funny moments. So I start putting these little pre-match videos together that were just kind of good morale boosters and nothing more. And that kind of evolved and evolved until we did like an early, club channel like online. It was one of the first sports, that's how it all started. So that's what we did. And then I went to work doing the same thing for the England cricket team. But I didn't, it was only because I had no other job to do. Like it wasn't like my dream job, but I just kind of, it was fun and I was filming things. But what it was a really good grounding, actually, looking back, for fly on the wall verite documentary filming, knowing when to shoot, knowing when to sort of sink into the background and not be seen, know how to manage different characters, understand like almost storytelling in sport and all this kind of stuff. So it's actually like the best training I could probably possibly have, going around with this England cricket team, around the world and seeing all these different cultures and getting used to being in different countries and India, Bangladesh and South Africa and all these different places. So yeah, it was actually the best grounding, but I wouldn't ever say I earned it particularly. I think I was quite lucky. I just kind of fell into it. But I had a lot of fun doing it. But I also realised, okay, I want to tell longer form stories, and that's when Warriors came about, really.
But it sounds like it was the sort of right thing at the right time, right place. But you were the right person for it, right?
Of course.
Because if someone else had done it, it wouldn't have progressed in that way if you didn't suit you and you didn't suit.
I mean, that's true. And I think also it definitely, I understood how to be around, I guess, sort of pro sports people quite early on. And I learned how to navigate the dressing rooms and those environments. So that's helped me quite a lot.
So tell us, give us some insight about that.
I just think exactly as like the tactic I used when it's in McEnroe's kitchen is you don't take your ego in the room. Like, you're on a hiding to nothing if you do that. That's not why you're there. So you can't... You have to accept that you're not going to meet them necessarily on that level, but it doesn't mean you need to be a doormat. Like, but it just means you have to have a surety of self, but you don't need to compete with these people. I think that's one of the first things, and also just sense the environment. Like I'd say, I don't know about you guys, but like I grew up in a in a slightly like tricky home environment, so I became quite attuned to like sensing moods and all that kind of stuff. So subsequently, that then helped me get in a dressing room, a sporting dressing room with like big egos and things going wrong or what have you, or people's careers on the line, you know, whatever it might be. You sense the energy in the air and you sense all that. So that really helped me then. And then going forward, definitely for somebody like John McEnroe, like there are signs when he's going to pop. There are signs when he's going to blow.
Yeah.
So you have to, I think, be attuned to that really. So it's interesting when you look, you can see your, like almost what you've learned at a much, much younger ages have sort of fused into your professional career.
And then in terms of things that have influenced you, you know, outside of your immediate situation, so films and documentaries and sort of music that's influenced you, you know, starting with documentary films, you know, are there any particular films or particular directors that sort of looking back you think, yeah, that's been quite formative for me, or is it other stuff?
Yeah, no, it's always a terrifying question because I'm probably the worst documentarian for that. But there was a film I remember before I'd ever made anything. It was called Dark Days, or it is called Dark Days, and it was a shot all on, I think, 8mm film or 16mm film in New York. Would have been early 90s, all black and white, and it's about the people who lived in the subways of New York in their own like little encampments or communities and it's a brilliant film. I'm trying to remember the director. I want to say Mark Singer, but I'm not sure that is the right name, but it's definitely called Dark Days. And it had a DJ Shadow soundtrack. I remember that when that first record came out, introducing us.
There's a lot
of music from that is on it. That film has always stuck with me because it's this combination of a beautiful kind of bravery to it, going in, climbing into the subways and following these people. Also really eye-opening that like that kind of life and poverty exists in that city. Obviously we know more now, but at the time when I watched that film I didn't know. And sort of thirdly, just also like giving them, not giving them back, that's not right, but like showing their humanity, you know, like as people who had nothing but still cared about where they lived. You know, even though it was in the subway and it was dark and they had, you know, and their people come and steal their stuff, but they would start to protect themselves as communities in terms of looking after each other. And just like, that was just, I don't know, I just think it was such a beautiful film. And that's probably my favourite documentary I've ever seen, really. And then on the other scale, there's a film that was only a couple of years ago called Apollo 11, I think it was Apollo 11, which was 65mm film that had been rediscovered in the NASA archives and restored. And I don't know if you've seen that, but it's all it is. It's just the film of this Apollo launch and the build up to it. And the one that landed on the moon. And it's pieced together with just the kind of recordings of the time. There's no additional interviews, there's nothing like that. So it's just the most immersive, beautiful film of like one of the biggest moments in human history, I suppose. So it's interesting that those are the two that I sort of think of. They're like two extremes. But really, those are probably my most influential films in some way. I don't know what they are. I think more in spirit than imagery.
But they both sound like they're really getting at something that's real.
Yeah.
And I guess your job as a documentary maker is to tell a story of something that is real, that's happened, and it sounds pretty sort of unfiltered and unedited in both.
Yeah, I think that's really desirable, because certainly the last few films and a lot of the stories at the moment, you are trying to find ways creatively to entertain and tell a story that's already happened.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the sort of documentaries that are commissioned now, that's a lot of them. I've not had the opportunity to do a Verite one for a little while now, and I definitely miss that. And I think I probably better at that, to be honest. But, you know, it's on me to probably go and find a new one, really.
Yeah, a lot of those, you know, the Netflix documentary series are great, but they all feel, they have a very similar feel to them, don't they? And
yeah, I think there's a new genre now, really, feels to me.
Oh, really?
I don't know, I mean, not officially, but like, you know, you can watch the Beckham series or something.
Yeah, and the Robbie Williams.
Yeah, they feel like content. They feel like, and there's a place for that, and I'm sort of not criticising that, but they don't feel, I still love the magic of a standalone film that you could watch in a cinema.
Yeah.
And be absorbed by it. That's always what appeals
to
me.
They feel very sycophantic, and maybe that's, they feel a bit like an advert for the person.
Yeah, well, that's the struggle now, because if you're going to get the rights to somebody that sees a documentary as part of their brand, to get those rights, you give up so much.
Yeah,
I think, particularly for those sorts of, and some of the time their production company is, you know, involved in making it. So that's why I mean it's a different form of document. It's a different thing. It's a different genre. We were quite lucky with McEnroe because I'd say he's one of the last of the old school sporting stars who, he is all about control, John, but weirdly not about the things you think. Like, he doesn't care, he'll say what he likes. You know, like, keep it in, it's fine. But he'll be very, like, he'll try to impose control on, you know, like, well, you shot that before you shot that, so why is it not after in the edit and stuff like that? You know, he's focused on really odd things. So we were quite lucky with that in that respect.
And what's the sort of source of that need for control with him?
With John? I just think that's his genetic makeup, really. Right. I think, you know, his wife Patty says quite early on that she's like, he's convinced that he's some, like, probably we all are, but, like, you know, he's on the spectrum to some relatively large degree, or a reasonable degree. I think she says that in the film. And I think that's probably quite evident in the film, and the way he sees the court, the way he's mathematically rapid, like the focus he'll give on certain things, and, you know, like, there's all these little ingredients in there that if you wanted to analyze that, someone far more qualified than me could. And I just think that's one of the really interesting parts of him, really. And he's like, yeah, probably.
What do you mean by mathematically rapid?
So he angles, percentages, everything, any maths thing, he'd be straight away. Yeah. Mm. So he would, like, work out on the court. He'd know the angles and degrees, like, instantly, which is why he was so, one of the reasons he was so good. But it also, I don't know if we ever quite got this across as much as I wanted, but I also felt like the court was a cage for him. That's what I was like. He needs boundary and he needs things to be mathematically sound. But if an umpire, if he sees things and his brain knows mathematically he's right, and an umpire saying he's wrong, it absolutely fries his circuits. He can't deal with that. And he can't deal with not being listened to either. This is the thing. He doesn't want everybody to agree with him. He doesn't need that. He needs people to listen to him. So when he feels like he's not listened to, that's when he really gets frustrated.
That's so interesting, yeah.
So there's all these facets that everybody's got. You know, everyone's got all these little interesting... But I just found that, it was a bit of a dream sort of scenario, really, where someone's that open.
And what is next? I mean, it seems obviously there are a lot of films out now, which is the theme around great sportsmen. You know, the Williams one won an Oscar. You know, so I think for people like us growing up, where we saw these heroes, and, you know, that. And then we are like, actually, I was really young. I didn't really understand. Let me just find out. So they are really, really popular at the moment. But, like, the real documentary, when I was growing up, I was watching documentary where, like, you've got someone following, you know, a pile of animals or a particular, you know, kind of tribe living somewhere for a while. And something that we haven't seen before. That, to me, was what documentary was about. I mean, do you feel like that? And is it dying?
I mean, yeah, I do feel like that. I feel like we were just sort of saying, in a way, like, I do feel there's like subgenres have kind of been created. I'm working on one that's just in development at the moment, which I can't actually fully talk about. But it's a bit more, it's a bit more nature driven, and it's a bit more, actually seeing things there in camera rather than, looking back on something. I think with sporting stories, I feel like there's a golden era of most of those sporting stories from a kind of big hero perspective. The ones that I would find interesting have probably been told. Not ever all of them, but a lot of them. Because I feel like now everyone films everything. So there's something magic about stuff that you know is quite rare and you know is on film and it's like scratchy, but it pings, you know, it's just beautiful. Whereas now everyone films everything all the time, so there's not really any mystery to anything. So I feel like the current age of sporting stories is not really going to be as special as the kind of the batch that we've had in the last 10 to 15 years. And maybe that will usher further forward to, more of the kind of verite stuff, more of the camera on the shoulder. Yeah. Let's follow, let's try and go somewhere where no one's gone before, that kind of thing. But I think there's also a lot more awareness now. And this is it's quite a difficult documentary, because one of the things I love about documentary is getting to see different cultures and travel. But if you're making, for example, an environment film or something about the natural world or anything like that, then there is then a kind of added responsibility, guilt, I don't know, for extensive travel to make that film and all this kind of stuff. So it's really changed the dynamic, I think, of how you could think about creating things and making films and all that kind of stuff. So it's an interesting period. And I don't know what the answer is to all that. Because as I say, part of the beauty of documentary is going and meeting people in their cultures and in their environments and where they live and seeing new parts of the world. So it sort of presents you with a bit of a quandary if you're concerned about like lots of air travel and stuff like that. I don't know the answer to that one.
I think follow on from that is more we all want, you know, as people, storytelling is what defines us. You know, it's from the beginning, everything has been about story. You know, the Bible is written in a story form, Quran.
Greek mythology, you know, the same stories that get told that we always gravitate back to, because they just, it gives us, it's the structure that we crave to give us meaning in life and make it to make sense.
And I think that is really, it's nature, isn't it? We are drawn towards, you know, story, hence television, hence radio. You know, we wanted to tell stories. So in a way, I think these days, people will watch stories because it's coming live to them. Some, you know, people watch stories, which is what make documentary such a brilliant thing is, you know, you can switch on the television and you could watch a documentary about almost anything, right? So I find it really, really fascinating. So I'm surprised that it almost sounds like a big production is always going towards these big sports personalities and that get promoted really well. I mean, I must admit, David Beckham's promotion was in my throat.
Yeah.
You know, and I love the guy, you know, but I was like, wow, this is like, you know, this is big, right? And if you haven't heard of it, then you are not in this world. We're not in, I don't know, but Beckham was a big thing.
Yeah.
Even so much so that I thought, I'm not going to watch it. I've heard so much. But that's what I mean. So I think the real storytelling, and from listening to you, it seems like your first, you know, I watched a brief bit about, you know, the Messiah. We were talking about it. I was like really fascinated by that. But that actually, I like that. They're almost like, what do you mean they are playing cricket?
Yeah, it's bizarre. I totally agree. I think and what you're talking about story as well, like that's how we like commune and feel things and empathize and all this kind of stuff. And particularly in our lives, a lot of the time you kind of shut down those elements of you because you're too stressed, you don't have time, you're like all these things. But like since the beginning of time, stories, how we passed on what we've learned, like that's it's the essence of I think everything really. And that's why I love being involved in documentary. But for me, it doesn't have to just be that. It can be any form of storying. I think writing a song is exactly the same. Painting, anything, like anything where you communicate emotion, for me, is it's just the most joyous, I think one of the most joyous parts of being alive, really. So, yeah, I do get frustrated when, and I think it is happening in documentary a lot, when the market is distorted by these multi-million pound projects that are not designed necessarily to be like real, genuine, emotional, beautiful stories of authenticity and truth, ideally. but, you know, something a bit different. I think there's a place for all that. And I'm sure some people probably have different arguments and say, well, actually, the finance of that then goes into different areas of the industry. So I don't want to be like on a soapbox about it, but I do feel that it has, the market has distorted a little bit. People want icons, they want big sports stars, or like a huge nature film, I think.
So, or horrific crimes.
Or horrific crimes. You know, like that's where if you have one of those stories, you'll get the money to make your film. But these beautiful human like stories that actually really affect some people, I think they're just harder and harder to find finance for. So I think that will, like everything, there's a wheel to this stuff. I think it'll probably come back round, but at the moment that's kind of where it's at. But you just have to find a way. I think that's on the flip side of that, I would say that, you know, I made the first film that I did and loads of people made the first one later just by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. I think if you've got that desire to do anything, it doesn't matter what it is really, but if it's in your heart, then you will keep going and you'll find a way to make it happen. Mm. And I know that's, you know, I know that is said with a, like, it's a privileged position, but like, I do think there's a real element of truth to that. You've got to have the love in it. You've got to love something to go through the tough times to yeah. make something. Yeah. So yeah, that's probably how I feel about it.
We always ask a couple of questions about Sussex.
The mighty Sussex.
Well, this is a Sussex-based podcast. You grew up in Brighton, right?
I did, yeah. Just outside Brighton, actually, in one of its golden suburbs.
Patcham. Nice. Yeah. I didn't realise I would have spoken to you with more respect.
So. Absolutely.
So you grew up in Brighton, and now you live in...
I live in Lewis now.
Yeah. How long have you lived in Lewis?
Only since April, so just under a year.
And what brought you here?
Good question. Pubs, probably.
What's your favourite pub?
Well, I do like the Lewis Arms, but I have to say, I went to the Abyss and I was like, wow.
That's great. Yeah.
This is like Shoreditch in Lewis. I did not know this was hidden away. So it just what I like about Lewis, both coffee and pubs, is that there's a place to suit your mood. I think there is one, at least one place where you can go and sort of chill out. But yeah, I think just generally, I kind of, you know, I love the history of Lewis. I'm of that age where I don't need a mate, big city. I need something I can get around it. The hill's a bit of a problem.
the knees are a bit crazy. Yeah, try jogging with him on the hills.
Oh, that's man. Treadmills. Yeah, I can't run on the streets. So just that, really. And it's got the kind of things I like. The little cinema, which is great. Station to London if I ever get a job. So, you know, all those things are in there. And that's kind of what brought me here. But I wanted to be here for a while, and I've got friends here and things. But what with the mortgage scenarios and all that kind of stuff, it was a bit trickier. It took me a little bit longer, but made it in the end. There's another warning. That's a good thing about documentary. You don't go in it to get rich. Most people, I mean, a few people do, but most people don't. They do it for the love of it.
Yeah. I mean, it is. back on the Lewis thing, right? Yeah. And actually, you know, you mentioned like, wow, Shoreditch in Lewis. It's quite fun because over the years, I mean, I've only been here for 9 years now. But over the years, you kind of see the demographics changing, right? And then you're kind of getting people in our age groups with young kids. And when you go out, you almost kind of feel, hang on, why are you here? It's all of a sudden, it's almost like these guys are living here now. It's almost like Londoners or Brightonians or, you know. Do you kind of find that Lewis is not like years back where, you know, kind of, you know, can you see that changing?
Definitely. I think I've seen that change since even April, I think.
Really?
Like, I don't know, I mean, I've been quite surprised, actually. In the last couple of months, I've started to think, oh, gosh, actually, well, either I'm getting really old really quickly, or everyone's like, there seems to be quite a lot of younger people in Lewis. So I was like, oh, that's good. And slightly more diverse as well. Like, just starting to... And I think you're absolutely right. I think people are moving out of Brighton. I think that's part of it. Moving out of London as well. Yeah. I mean, Lewis is not the cheapest place in the world, so... I do think that sort of restricts movement here to some degree, but I definitely have noticed a change. I think, and also generally places that are opening up feel a little bit more catering to kind of, I don't want to be ageist, but like maybe younger yeah. sort of clientele and stuff like that, I suppose. But it's great. I think there's a real vibrancy, and I don't know if it's spring or whatever, but like I feel like the town's sort of coming alive again a little bit.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's really got a bit out of, you know, for a small sort of market town, it's got a great vibe. The thing I can tell about Lewis, it's a nice town. Everyone goes around saying hello to each other. It's like a sport in Lewis. I'm going to say hello to people I don't know today. Everyone's just like, no, no. And then you go 2 miles out to sort of like Ringmer, something like that. No disrespect, Ringmer. And like you carry on saying hello to people, and people looking like forcing what you are, man. and I love that. And I think that the reason Lewis is like that is because you get people moving down from London, moving up from Brighton. People just have a really positive outlook on life. And certainly where my kids go to school, all of the sort of kids that have joined over the last 5 years, their parents have almost invariably moved from London, and they're all sound, and we're all now mates, and we'll go drinking down the abyss. You know, it's great. It's part of the evolution of the town, and the town will never turn its back on its history, and that's what's great.
Combination.
It's a forward-looking town, and it's still got that sort of sense of tradition. And a lot of places are sort. Very wary of change and very wary of the future. I think Lewis embraces it.
Yeah, and I think it still keeps its individuality. And as you say, it's history. And I love that. I love that it's got this kind of wild side to it as well. Like, at any moment, like, the people could revolt.
To have something like this, Bonfire, which we often talk about on this, you know, it doesn't have a sort of central organiser. It's completely organic. It completely happens. It's community driven, and has done, and it will outlive all of us.
Yeah,
you know, and it will continue. And I love that.
Well, it was really interesting to experience it from the inside.
This year. Like literally inside, yeah.
Yeah, I had a good view of it. Yeah. But just even from the more like the cannon, I didn't know a cannon went off at like 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. Yeah. The windows rattle.
You're like, what is that?
Yeah, literally wakes my kids up.
Yeah,
every year.
I couldn't believe it. And I was, but it woke me up, and I was like, oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. It's absolutely brilliant. And then, so we were kind of up, and then went for a breakfast in the patch. And like, there were people already in there. Pints, eight a.m. and they're up there. Obviously, they're their bar, and I was like, "Wow!" Like, this is, I thought people just got going, you know, like 4 or 5 o'clock. I thought, "This is serious." And then, throughout the day, you could just feel this energy building, which, as I say, I hadn't experienced from like inside the town before, and you know, I'd always come in the evening. So it was really, really great to get this different insight, and it felt much more, wild. It felt much more, I guess, in a way, authentic. Yeah. When you turn up to an event and you get on a train or whatever it might be, or you it feels like, oh, I'm going to this organised thing and it's a bit chaotic, it's a bit wild. But actually, I got a much different feeling for it on the day, which was great. I absolutely loved it.
I could see this happening. I could hear some documentary happening with it.
I think there've been one or two slightly rubbish documentaries about.
It's a hard one. You need a pretty epic central character that's going to take you through, and then I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if you've seen they do other events on the Priory Park where they, like, you know, they kind of showcase the olden days.
Oh, like Battle Ring, I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen it. I'd definitely go to that.
Of course. Of course you would.
That would be brilliant. I tell you what, not quite as eventful, but I went to watch the Skittles in the summer.
Oh, that's great, isn't it? Really good fun.
My friend, she said, oh, we're just playing the Skittles scene, come down. I was like, yeah, sure. I went down. It was like a county cricket match. There was like sponsor boards, like strips laid out, bars. It was brilliant.
So good. People getting tanked on a Wednesday in the Grange. Really lovely.
So honestly, to have that
in
the town, coming as a new person, just to have all those things actually happening, it's honestly so lovely. I've got one complaint.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Here it comes. Here it comes.
So I don't know how this has happened, but down at the riverside where the sweet shop.
Yes. Place, Grumpy Sweet Shop Woman.
Yeah.
Well, I think she likes me now because I am a regular purchaser of the wine gums. All over it. But since I've started buying them, someone else has started buying it. There's a wine gum competition. So I go in there sometimes on a Saturday and it's empty. Fuming. Absolutely. I was like, you know I'm coming in every Saturday. Where are my wine gums? But she seems to, I think, sometimes enjoy the fact that I go away empty-handed. but I feel like I'm making progress.
She's chipping away,
softening a
little. Yeah. There's your documentary.
But I love that.
I love that someone can be so grumpy, and like everyone's going there.
Yeah.
It's almost like the drawer, isn't it?
Yeah. Amazing.
And like, she's making up, like, they serve ice cream in the summer. She hates it. People going like, oh god, like dishing up another ice cream. It's like, you're selling it, man.
Well, she's watching it. I'm really sorry. If you're watching it, I'm really sorry. I get my wine gums there. And just the markets are great as well. There's a little market under the tower.
Tower.
So we go there and get my partner. She gets all her mushrooms from there, like from the mushroom man. He's pretty cool. So he keeps, I think he's about 90, but he keeps like saying, oh, do you want to come foraging with me for mushrooms?
Oh, really? So there's a mushroom festival happening. Have you seen it? It's called All Things Fungi. I've seen it advertised.
I think I saw it last year. I haven't heard tell him about that.
Yeah, maybe.
She'll be there.
Yeah, she's into the mushrooms.
Yeah, she'll be there. But she knows all about it, so she's like, we went sort of along the river. There's a certain elderberry. To pick the elderberries at a certain time. There's millions of them down there. So she makes like elderberry. One of those, a berry. That she knows. There's millions of them down there. So she makes all these like special like remedies and all sorts. So
nice.
I think she quite likes to open an apothecary. One of them.
Right.
But it would work
in Lewis, wouldn't it?
It'd be kind of
old school apothecary. Oh, yeah.
It would be brilliant, but I don't know how many herbs you need to sell to pay the lease in Lewis. That's the problem.
Yeah, if there's only one. Yeah. It's under the counter. I think it's probably, you know, be competing with Tizzy's, maybe.
Yeah, trouble. But, you know, dreams.
And just on your partner, very briefly, where did you meet?
Where did we meet? We met, funnily enough, my friend Camilla runs a art school, like kind of online / they do courses out in places, art school, and she was on that course, and Camilla was, you should meet my friend Barney, blah blah blah, So that's how it happened. We got set up, basically, I suppose. Yeah, that was like, I don't know, 7.5 years ago now.
Oh, so, brilliant.
Yeah, so quite a long time ago.
Excellent.
And that really works, right? That sort of stuff. Yeah, so I suppose it does. Yeah, it does really well. But yeah, so she's down here, I mean, most of the time at the moment in Lewes, because she just loves it. She's got a place in London, but she's rented it out now. So yeah. Yeah, she likes being down in Lewes. So. Yeah. And also, I think her mortgage has gone absolutely through the roof. So. She's like, I can't afford it.
Coming down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Live rent-free. Yeah. Yeah. We're loving it. Really enjoying the town. Really enjoying it. And I have to big shout out to the macaroni fries in Catron Tales. I don't know if you've had those.
They're out of control.
They are a disgrace. They are a disgrace. You could run it all day, every day for a week. Have one of those and it's ruined.
Yeah. And the donuts are out of this world. Gosh. Aren't they? Yeah. Absolutely mind blowing.
I just only do one. Maybe one kind of indulgence in Lewes, and but one thing, that new bakery that I haven't Gales. Been in it yet, the new one in where
on the corner.
Bang used to be.
Yeah,
it looks pucker. I don't know. Is anyone of you been?
Yeah, the kids went there. People from the kids went there. Yeah, they said it was very nice. Yeah, they said it was really good. I went there. The queue was too big, and I'm lazy and old school, so I went bake out. Got something beige and meat based, cheese based.
It's definitely hoovering up people who don't want to walk up the hill, isn't it? It's prime, location.
Just the right location.
Flintstone must be like,
I know. Well, Flintstone's going to have to drop their prices for
exactly. That's such a good point. Shall I have the walk?
Because you sort of
walk or pace
tune. I've been there, you're at the bottom of that hill, and you're like, that's really hoovering up,
What a perfect place to end it. Barney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Chalk It Up, and if you did, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with friends and family. You can also follow us on Instagram at Chalk It Up Sussex Podcast, where you can find exclusive content, including video footage of some of our shows. Thank you for listening.